You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimena toku ingoa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wā, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire. Today is Wednesday, the 7th of June. I'm your host today, Shimena, and I'm joined in the studio, by my producers, Will and Adam. So today, coming up on the show, we speak with Greater Auckland editor regarding a proposed road congestion tax. We talk to Tracy Martin from New Zealand First about providing students with programs that promote healthy and safe relationships, as well as about Winston Peters' divisive comments yesterday in Parliament in response to the recent terror attacks in Britain and yesterday's one in Melbourne. AUT's Alan Blackman joins us again this week for Dear Science, today discussing dodgy dealings within academia. The Minister for the Environment and the Green Party speak with us regarding the acceptance of a water conservation order proposal. And Massey University's David Brougham discusses the potential impacts of the growing use of automatons in New Zealand's job market. As always, please get in touch with us about any of your thoughts about the content that we're covering on today's show. 5395 is the number to text, or 309 3879 is the studio phone line.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Yes, so first up on The Wire today, a joint agreement between the Auckland City Council and the government has been reached today regarding a smarter transport pricing project for Auckland City. Announced this morning, the two bodies will embark on an ambitious plan to reduce demand and ease congestion across Auckland's roading infrastructure. One method which the project will explore will be the potential congestion tax applied to road users. I spoke with Greater Auckland editor Matthew Lowry about this tax, first asking him exactly what it entails.
So the government are looking at what they call smarter transport pricing. So yeah, internationally, there's a wide range of things it could be. It goes from tolls on motorways to a cordon charge, which is like what's in London and in Stockholm, where you get charged for crossing a certain area into the central city, for example. But what's recommended from previous work is a wide-level transport road pricing scheme, where probably based on GPS or something like that, where you're actually tracking where vehicles are travelling, so it's not just targeting motorways or an area, but targeting the whole city, so that if you're driving on a local road, you're going to get charged as well as if you're driving on a motorway. And the reason for that is that avoids some of the negative impacts from implementing it. So, for example, if you were to put a cordon charge on around the central city, it makes it more valuable to live inside that cordon because you're not paying that tax every time you cross a boundary. If you put a toll on motorways, people might try and avoid the motorways by clogging up local roads. And so having a wide-ranging scheme helps cover all of those and helps change behaviour and how people travel.
Right, so a blanket charge across the whole city seems more likely.
Yeah, and that's where technology comes in now with the GPS and all those sorts of technologies, where you can actually track where people are and charge them accordingly. So if you're living out in a rural part of Auckland, for example, or you know somewhere where it's not congested, you won't pay as much to drive on the local roads there as you would if you're living in an area that's highly congested. So the idea is that you charge people a different price based on where they're driving and when they're driving. So if you're driving at the peak, you'll pay more than if you're driving off-peak, for example, when the roads are quiet. And our whole idea is to get better use out of our road network, because it generally tends to be very, very peaky, where you have a lot of investment in road, you know, road building goes into providing for a short period of time, providing capacity for a short period of time. So you know, there's a peak period of time over an hour or two in the morning and in the evening. Now, outside of that, it can often be free-flowing and not a problem and often overcapacity. So it's about trying to spread people's travel out throughout the day to get a better use of the resource we have already.
Right, so it would essentially incentivise carpooling and public transport over single-use or single-person driving.
Yeah, that's one of the things it does, is it would encourage people to travel by other means or just not travel at all at that time. So, you know, if people are travelling to at 9 o'clock in the morning or, say, 8 o'clock in the morning, perhaps it's a trip that they can make at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock. So it's changing behaviour. You know, it doesn't mean they can't drive. It just means it might be better for them to drive at a different time. But that also means that we have to have, you know, for example, if it's about people moving between roads and driving in public transport or walking and cycling, we have to have those options available for them so that they can actually move to that.
Have there been any indications regarding how much this might be charged for the average Auckland road user?
So some previous work, Johnny did it at a high level, and you know, this study that's been announced today is about, you know, getting the details to finding out exactly what it would be charged at. But some previous suggestions are it could be between, you know, 3 cents a kilometre and 40 cents a kilometre, depending on those, you know, time of day and location factors. So, you know, perhaps up to 40 cents a kilometre that you could be paying to travel. So if you're travelling, you know, 10 kilometres to work, you know, you could be paying $4 to do so.
I also understand that the council currently has a shortfall of around $10 billion for current Auckland transport infrastructure. Is this going to be used as sort of a solution to fill that financial gap?
Well, that's where it's really interesting. Some really interesting comments from within the details that have been out today. So, you know, Phil Goff says there's a $7 billion funding gap at the moment, which comes from projects that we say that we need to get built over the next decade, and that we don't currently have the funding for. So we expect that there'll be a certain level of funding every year that's coming from the council and government. You factor those in already, and you've still got a $7 billion shortfall. And so one of the interesting comments from the terms of reference release is that the intention is that this road pricing would replace fuel prices, fuel charges and road user charges in Auckland. So it would not necessarily raise any more money. It might raise some more money, but it's not intended to raise money. It's intended to change behaviour. You know, how that translates to raising additional money we need to build all these projects that we've got to build is unclear. And also, that also, by its very nature, raises the issue of why the government have been opposed regional fuel taxes for Auckland, which Phil Goff has promoted, because one of the basis for doing so is that it would create a disparity in Auckland where Auckland pays more than the rest of the country, and that's unfair. And in this case, Auckland would be paying lower fuel taxes than the rest of the country because you're paying this road pricing instead. So that creates some interesting questions around there.
So sort of a side effect of this congestion charge being brought in would see the lowering of petrol prices around Auckland?
From the information we've seen so far, that's one of the goals of the scheme is that it would replace fuel pricing, or some of it anyway. And so the idea being that it's relatively revenue neutral, so the amount of revenue gathered by the government and the council stays about the same, but it changes how they get it and how it's collected. You know, we have to wait and see details as to exactly what impact that has, but then that, by its very nature, doesn't go to do anything towards addressing the shortfall that we already have.
Is there any indication as to when this congestion charge might be fully implemented into the Auckland system?
My guess is it would take 5 to 10 years before we can actually get it up and working. You know, these things tend to take quite a bit of time. There's a lot of design and development to do, and then you have to think about the logistics of if we need to put a GPS device in every person's car, for example, you know, what that entails and how we do that, you know, how we use technology, can we use smartphones, so that all those sorts of questions need to be answered by the study as to how we go about it and how we, you know, how it's enforced and all those issues. So, you know, there's a huge amount of unknowns yet as to how it will work and when it will, how long it will take to implement.
Right. 5 to 10 years seems like a very long time for something like this to come in. What would happen if, say, in 5 years it is implemented, but congestion has dropped due to light rail being implemented or another form of public transport coming in? Would it then make this sort of a redundant fix, if there'd be nothing really there to fix anymore?
No, so there's two parts of that. Is one example we can look at for the implementation is Singapore. So they currently have tolls on various roads, and they're introducing a wide range. They'll be the first in the world to introduce a GPS-based road pricing scheme, and they started that last year, and it's not going to be implemented until 2020. And so they've already got a road pricing, you know, scheme in place. The population's already used to using and paying for the use of roads, and even that's going to take, you know, 4 years to implement. So I don't think it's unrealistic to think that 5 years is too far away. If anything, you know, 5 years might still be too soon. But we're still going to do all the analysis as to actually just how it would even work and how much we need to charge to actually make a difference and all those sorts of things. The other side of your question is about the public transport impacts and other projects. The answer is no. They're not going to solve congestion, and they won't remove congestion. So, you know, the goal of building projects like light rail and the City Rail Link is not to get people, not to address congestion, but to give people more options as to how they get around and more capacity. So more people can move and choose to move without sitting in congestion, but there will still be congestion. And there's a number of factors that we've seen in transport worldwide where if you take one person off the motorway, someone else will replace them because they'll be making an extra trip where they wouldn't have made it before. It's called induced demand, where if you see it's working, and people will, you know, see traffic flowing, then people will make more trips to compensate. And so you won't actually see any reduction in congestion as a result of those projects.
The Wire. I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Greater Auckland editor Matthew Lowry speaking about the announcement this morning of a potential congestion tax for Auckland City. If you have an opinion on this issue, please vote in our Twitter poll, which is on our 95BFM News Twitter page, if you're in support of a citywide congestion tax or not. We'd love to hear from you.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Yes, I have Tracy Martin here with me now. How are you doing, Tracy?
I'm good, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. First up today, let's talk about research that was released last week that revealed some alarming statistics about youth relationships, such as how 20% of female and 9% of male secondary school students have experienced sexual abuse, with most cases involving a boyfriend, girlfriend or a friend. So we do already have a program for students that promotes healthy and safe relationships called Mates and Dates, which is currently being delivered in 23% of high schools for year 9 to 13. Students. But New Zealand First is calling to offer programs for all Year 10 students. Why Year 10 specifically?
It's based on a model that I've been working with the Women's Refuge in Rodney for. And so it's based on a model that includes understanding around coercive control inside of a relationship, understanding around consent and so on and so forth. So we've made it at Year 10 because we want it to be delivered compulsorily inside the curriculum, and we don't want to interfere with Year 11, 12 and 13, which are currently exam years. And we also know that there are the other programs like Leslie Elliott's programs, Love Me Not and so on, that are also going to run alongside of those continually with some of those older students.
But is having an exam enough of a reason not to engage with, you know, really important information about how young men and women should be treating each other? I'm just concerned that isn't Year 10 just doing this education for 1 year? That might not be enough for young people.
That's not what the pilot has showed us. The pilot's been running for 5 years just in the schools in the Rodney electorate. And what that has been showing us, but unfortunately it's only been had enough funding to target Year 10 individuals that have been identified as at risk, and that's one of the other things about the policy. We want it for every student. We don't want to try and predict who will need this level of education and who won't. So what the pilot's showing us is that Year 10 is the start of really complex relationships tend to start being formed, and we want to jump in really early, particularly around that understanding of coercive control and understanding around consent. And that just builds on the other programs that are still in place as students get older.
Mm. And so the research that was released last week also discussed how violence in youth relationships has been connected with bullying in primary and intermediate schools. So has New Zealand First considered rolling out programs in these younger, you know, primary intermediate schools as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's another piece of work that we're doing. It's a bigger piece of work, and there's three or four pilots again, or three or four really good examples of how anti-bullying programs can be placed inside of the school network. And one of those requires professional development of the teaching staff and the adults that are inside the school so that they recognise the behaviours in themselves, as well as recognising the signs of somebody who is being bullied. So we're still working on that policy space because there's some really good examples of it, but we're just looking at which way we think we should jump.
Mm. And in terms of intervention services for people who've already experienced or used relationship abuse, the research that was released last week described how there weren't enough specific intervention services on offer for young people. Is this also something New Zealand First is looking at introducing?
It is. It's another piece of policy work I'm talking with, mostly around with Women's Refuge and some of the other organisations. Sharkey, again, is another one that we're having a few conversations with, particularly for their migrant community or different people from different cultural backgrounds, so that we make sure that they're all appropriate. And I think the other thing too is we have to look at the ratio between counselling staff inside our secondary schools, the ratio between counselling staff and the number of students they are being asked to care for, and whether that ratio needs to be dropped, and then what access do they have to services outside the school to make sure that they then can recommend on. So it's a pretty big picture.
Mm-mm. I mean, but some of the research, so that research that was released last week also said about some of the barriers that exist for young people in relation to intervention services that are currently on offer, that often they don't really feel comfortable speaking to adults, and that they're more comfortable speaking to their peers. I mean, is this also being considered when developing these future possible programs?
Yeah, I mean, many schools are running a peer mediation program, so there's some professional development for young people at year 12, year 13 to actually be support networks for their peers. However, when you start getting into really, really extreme levels of violence, whether it be sexual violence or physical violence, I think what we are going to need to do, and one of the first jobs I ever had when I was at school was I was actually a youth line telephone counsellor. So the fact that those services have been starved for funding and that Youthline is having to fight to survive is another, again, it's another little space that I'm trying to work on and make sure that we get our funding models right, and how can we actually assist for that sort of access to be just more prevalent around the country.
Mm. And so also the research said last week that new programs should think globally and act locally, so capitalising on international research about effective programs, but also making sure it's culturally relevant to our own context. So, for example, taking a specific approach with young Māori. So is this also something New Zealand First would incorporate into their plan to roll out these effective programs in New Zealand?
Yeah, absolutely, because it's not just, I mean, certainly you've got young Māori, you've got young Pacifica, you've actually got different people of different faith backgrounds. So you're dealing with students that that may not have a faith, and then you might be dealing with students that are Christian-based or some other faith-based. You know, you've got to be able to provide for the individual so that they feel safe to seek assistance. Mm. So that's the complex nature of it, but at the same time, it's the essential nature of it. All that is part of the conversation, definitely.
Mm. And so I'd also like to talk to you today about New Zealand First's comments yesterday in Parliament in response to the London terror attacks. So Winston Peters said New Zealand's Islamic communities must clean house, and that this should start with their own families. Isn't putting the onus purely on the Islamic community for situations like this encouraging divisive rhetoric?
He didn't say that New Zealand's Islamic communities needed to clean house. He said that Islamic communities needed to start, and he didn't identify New Zealand specifically. We were talking about it in the context of the London attack.
He was also implying that this relates to New Zealand, though, because he did go on to say about, before something like this happens in New Zealand, we need to take a stand for what we believe in New Zealand. So he was sort of implying that this relates to New Zealand Islamic communities as well.
I'm not saying that he didn't mean that the full Islamic community. I'm just saying that he didn't specifically say the New Zealand Islamic community, all right? With regard to, and if you actually go back and have a look at the speech, if you put it into the context of what he said that we will be told that these are lone wolf attackers, that nobody knew what they were going to do, that members of their extended family or extended community will plead ignorance, and that is not possible, and that they need to step up, just in the same way that, say, let's just put it into a New Zealand situation of those nannies up in the north who actually turned in all their grandchildren for doing those crimes up in the north. You know, there is a level where we all have to participate in making sure that if we see that a crime may take place, we must actually act on it to try and prevent it.
I mean, but it's a bit speculative, though, saying that the families of the assailants knew about their plans and that it's their fault. Kind of, yeah, implying that it's not their it's their fault for not speaking up. So when I think, doesn't the solution go a bit more widely than that, rather than just these families, blaming these families?
I don't, I guess it depends on whether you've decided that he was blaming them, as opposed to actually saying that these communities need to take action. And if people know, then they need to step forward and actually make sure the authorities know. If we take one of the young men that was shot in London the other day, one of the perpetrators. Now, see, two people of his community had drawn the attention of the police to that young man and his actions, and said that they were dangerous and they were concerned about his actions. And so the next part of what, if communities do report, then there must be action taken by the by the police, by the other organisations that are then charged with our protection. So, yeah, it's not a single silver bullet, but certainly we must participate if we see that there is possibly a crime going to take place.
Yeah, I don't know. I just worry that the rhetoric, that, like Winston's yesterday in Parliament, sort of encourages broad anti-Muslim sentiment when really it's only a small sliver of Muslims who are Islamic extremists.
But how would you say Islamic extremists then, if that is exactly... How else would you describe these young people who are Islamic extremists if you can't use the phrase Islamic extremist?
No, but I mean, he's saying that, you know, the Islamic community must do something about this. But the Islamic community around the world and in New Zealand have been very critical of the attacks. And, have you know, the Federation of Islamic Associations of New Zealand president has said of the attackers that they are a bunch of lunatics who have completely taken verses of the Quran out of context and built up their own destructive ideology. I mean, I think the Islamic community, the broad Islamic community throughout the world is just as horrified as the non-Islamic community about these attacks.
And I don't disagree with you. I think what Winston Peters said yesterday was that members of the, and what he said quite clearly in a sentence was, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, family members and community members of these monsters, and he used the word monsters, for people who go in to kill the innocent indiscriminately, must step forward and actually report before these things happen. If they know something, they must report it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me this week, Tracy. I'll talk to you again next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
I'd been starting to think that everything was just getting worse. Summer's hotter, winter's colder. Someone let a loaf of bread with a face drawn on it be Prime Minister. And now, all my targeted advertising is for weight loss and cheap therapy. But then,
I heard that B Street was coming back. B Street, 95BFM's K-Row Block Party, is returning soon. Escape the doom and gloom with good times, great music, and 95BFM.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can f*** off.
Yes, indeed, it is now time for Dear Science. We've got Alan Blackman from AUT joining us here in the studio. Kia ora, Alan.
Hi, Shamina.
How are you doing?
I am very well.
Getting back to the swing of things of New Zealand life, away from your travels.
Yes, I know. Yes, it takes a bit of getting into it.
Yeah.
Yes.
The catching up, but then also like, oh, damn, being on holiday was real nice. Anyway, but first up.
Conference week,
we will be talking about some of your the things that you experienced during your travels.
We shall.
Later on the in the segment. But first, we're talking about how a peer reviewer stole and published data by another author. Talk to me about this.
Okay, so in order to sort of appreciate this and plus the other story that we're going to talk about, we've really got to talk in detail about how scientific reports or how scientific data is disseminated throughout the world, basically. So you're in the lab, you're doing all your experiments, you've got these great results, you write a paper, and then you submit it to a journal to get it published. So that's the way that the rest of the world gets to find out about what you've been doing. So when it comes to submitting to a journal, the way that it works, you've got your paper all typed up and everything, you submit it on an online portal generally, and then the manuscript goes to an editor of that particular journal. Now, journals can have one editor, they can have a whole hat full, depending on the particular journal. And it's those editors that then decide what happens to the manuscript at that point, whether or not it goes out to these people called peer reviewers. Mm-hmm. And the job of a peer reviewer is to judge the worth of the manuscript, the scientific worth, I guess, of the manuscript, whether it's good enough to be able to be published in the particular journal. And as I've said before on this program, there's a whole lot of sort of rankings of journals. You've got the very, very good ones. You've got your Natures, your Sciences, your proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, et cetera, et cetera, down to the average ones and down to the rubbish ones, which we'll talk more about later. So, you know, if you've got a really, really high-quality paper, you submit it to a really high-quality journal, they send it out to high-quality peer reviewers. And as I said, the job of the peer reviewer is to read critically the manuscript, point out any flaws, errors, and then they've got basically three choices. They can accept it as is, they can accept it with some revisions, or they can reject it. Mm. And it's very, 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 very rare that a paper gets accepted with no revisions whatsoever. Perfect papers don't exist.
Yeah.
So generally what happens is most of the time you get a letter back saying, yeah, we'll accept it, but you've got to make these little changes. You make the changes, goes back to the editor, they make sure that everything's been changed, blah, 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 and then it gets published. Mm. So that's the peer review system, and it really sort of operates on sort of implied honesty, I guess, because you are submitting your unpublished results, which may be earth-shattering, may be worth a Nobel Prize, you never know, and you are giving them away to complete strangers, and you don't know who those complete strangers are in terms of peer review. It's all an anonymous process. And so you're submitting those to people who, if they... really wanted to, could steal your results and publish them elsewhere. And sadly, that has happened more than a few times in the literature, and there's a recent example that we're talking about. So the journal was called the Elementary Pharmacology and Therapeutics Journal. And
in terms of how it sits compared to other journals, is it quite up there or middle range?
It's not my field, but I'd say it's probably sort of middle range sort of thing. It's quite unusual that this sort of thing goes on in very, very good journals, because you're going to get found out quite quickly. If you're going to do this sort of thing, the trick is to sort of do it in journals that are not brilliant, so that nobody sort of reads them.
You can get away with it.
So that you can get away with it, yeah. Yeah. And all that people are worried about these days, sadly, the whole, not point of academia, but a lot of academia is all about publish.
Yes.
And you've got to get those papers on your CV, and oftentimes it doesn't matter how good the journals are that you're publishing in, you just need papers, and then the bean counters then think, oh, this is good, they're publishing lots of papers, they must be really good, let's give them lots of money, sort of thing. And sadly, that's the way that academia is heading and has been heading for quite a while. So it's really important that you've got to publish. And so one easy way of publishing is stealing somebody else's results and passing them off as your own, which has happened in this particular case. Some authors in China published a paper, actually a review paper, in this particular journal. And then a couple of months after that, the paper was retracted. And that's a relatively rare thing to happen, is that a paper gets retracted. And the editor said that it was retracted basically because it contained material that could only have been accessible through the peer review process for another journal. And so that's quite a terse
very
sort of...
suspicious.
a very terse explanation. Often when papers are rejected, you don't get the whole story. It's just normally sort of a one sentence, this paper has been rejected because of plagiarism or something like that. Yeah. They never really go into detail, and it's the same with this one as well. So... they're basically saying that one of the authors of this Chinese paper obtained a manuscript to review for another journal. They stole some data out of that manuscript from the other journal and published it in this particular journal. And, you know, that's just not on.
Yeah.
And sadly, it used to be an absolute rarity, but now it's becoming more and more common. There's actually a website set up, a thing called retractionwatch.com, and this paper is dedicated, or this website is dedicated solely to papers that have been retracted from the literature, generally for fraudulent behavior. That's pretty much the way that you get a paper retracted.
I see. So, so depressing though, because I guess it just undermines that trust that exists in the academic community. Mm-hmm. With a peer review process, I mean, trusting people to check your work and give you robust feedback, and that it's all about contributing to, I don't know, the greater good, like creating
and
knowledge.
Absolutely, and that's what science is meant to be all about. It's not...
not this competition.
Right, yes. Yeah. So, you know, science itself is pure. It's the practitioners of science that aren't, unfortunately. And, you know, it just takes a couple of rat bags to ruin it for everybody. So when these sorts of things happen, then you're right. You do start losing trust in this process, which is, you know, very, very delicately balanced and does rely completely on trust.
Mm.
What kind of repercussions come from this? Like, if you get if it's found, like these guys were obviously evidently found.
Yeah.
What happens after that? Is it just the paper gets pulled, or?
Well, that's a really, really good question. And again, there should be probably more transparency in this. Yes, the paper gets pulled, number one, but then it's very, very rare that you find out what happens at the author's institution, okay? Because this will be reported to the chancellor or the vice chancellor or whatever, whichever particular university these guys are from. And then it's very unusual that you actually find out what happens, whether they get a rap over the knuckles or whether they're gone or whatever. So if you do want to know that, you've really got to basically keep a track of the literature and look out for these people's names and see if they keep publishing in the scientific literature. If they do, then you can assume that you know, they got a rap over the knuckles. If they don't, then you can assume something possibly worse for them anyway. So
yeah, I guess it just sort of reflects that increasing pressure on academics, though, to churn out research. I know that that sort of grows, it's been growing and growing and growing.
Absolutely, yes.
So,
And that sort of segues nicely into the second story.
Yeah, our next topic. A curious story about someone called Dr. Freud.
Indeed. So, because of this pressure to publish, not only are academics resorting to nefarious practices, but also nefarious people are resorting to nefarious practices, in that anybody can set up a journal.
Mm.
Absolutely anybody. So all you need is a web page and an editorial board, basically. So you've got yourself a web page, a nice cover design, editorial board, pictures of people from all over the planet and everything, and all of a sudden you're journal looks kosher when it's not. Now, there's two types of journals. There's the journals that you just submit the paper to and you don't have to pay anything to get published. And there's also the journals where you do have to pay to get published, okay? So the first type of journals, they go on subscriptions, basically. So for libraries and stuff like that, so they make their money out of subscriptions. The second ones, obviously, they make their money out of people paying to get into the journals, paying to get published. And these are called open access journals because basically they're open for everybody to see. So the subscription journals, the ones online, they're only available if you've actually got a subscription to that particular journal. So Auckland University and AUT, et cetera, you know, they'll subscribe to truckloads of journals. And there'll be some that they don't subscribe to, which the students here won't have access to. But the open access journals, everybody's free to see them because they're making their money from people paying to get published.
Isn't that almost a fundamentally flawed model? Because if they want to say,
you spotted it,
go away with your research, we don't want it, it's probably, it's, you know, it's flawed, you've stolen somebody's data or you've plagiarized, then they're not going to get the money.
Yeah, well, you'd think that, wouldn't you? But sadly, these types of journals are proliferating all over the web. And sadly, there's a lot of gullible academics out there who, needing stuff on their CV, okay, want to publish quickly, and these journals are going to accept anything. You pay them, you know, $500, you'll be in print the next week because they promise that their peer review will be very quick and almost always positive, okay, which means all the time. So a couple of academics, one in England and a few in Poland, decided to test this and to see whether or not they could sort of play the system, I guess. And so what they did was choose 360 journals, and 120 of them were very prestigious ones, 120 of them were good open access journals, and the other 120 were bad open access journals. They're so-called predatory journals, which basically accept money for publication. You pay the money, you will get published. No peer review or anything like that, despite their protestations to the contrary. So they invented a fictitious Dr. Anna Ozust. And Ozust in Polish means fraud. So her name was Dr. Fraud. They made up a CV for her, which was, again, entirely fictitious. All of the journals listed in her CV didn't exist. None of the book chapters existed. None of the publishing houses existed. And then what they did was to send the CV off to these 360 journals and said, hey, I'd really, really like to be on your editorial board. How about it, basically? And so of the 120 prestigious journals, none of them accepted her. Of the prestigious open access journals, 8 accepted her. And of the others, 40 accepted her. So she got accepted onto the editorial boards of 48 journals.
It's insane.
With a completely made-up CV. And so these journals that accepted her were saying, oh, we'll accept you maybe if you give us a payment, you know, we'll put you on the editorial board. They wanted her to submit papers or to get her colleagues to submit papers to these journals because, of course, they're going to make money out of that. They wanted her to organise conferences and they'd have a 60-40 split of the proceeds of the conference, so the publishers would get 60%, she'd get 40%. I mean, it's just a joke that this sort of stuff goes on, but sadly it really does. And you know, I get probably 5-10 emails a week from these sorts of people saying publish with us, we're the best, you know, blah 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 blah.
I was just thinking that when I was teaching at AUT that I would get so many emails. Just, you know, I guess maybe I didn't even know how they got my email address. But yeah, just from fake journals being like, pay some money and we'll publish you.
Yes, yeah. And it's absolutely, absolutely terrible. And sadly, as I say, there's a lot of gullible academics out there that need the CV padding, I guess, as we call it. And so, you know, they'll publish anywhere. And it's got to be stopped.
Yeah. So what is being done to stop this?
Well, very interesting. There was a very brave librarian by the name of Jeffrey Beal in the States. Mm. And he basically coined the term predatory journals, and the definition of those being basically journals who will accept money in exchange for guaranteed payment, publication. And so he ran a web page, and I think he was at University of Colorado, I believe. And what he did was to list all of these predatory journals on the web page. It's a very, very brave thing to do, and funnily enough, earlier this year, that list disappeared. So you go to that website now and it just said page not found, unfortunately. Oh, so he has obviously come under some pressure from either his university or from lawsuits or whatever, because that's the way the US runs. From these people who run these predatory journals. And, you know, that's just really, really sad. I think there's been a mirror site or two set up around the world to sort of
to keep
it going. Yeah. But, you know, when you come under the pressure of legal threats and stuff like that, it's very, very hard to ignore those, sadly. Mm. And I don't know what else can be done to stop all this except educating all the academics around the world and just saying, look, for God's sake, don't go publishing in these particular journals because it just exacerbates the whole situation.
Yeah, but I mean, so just this guy was doing that. Why is this not something that universities are taking a stronger approach towards? Because surely it's in their best interests to also quash these journals.
Indeed, and I'm sure the universities are coming under legal threat as well. I'm sure the University of Colorado must have come under pressure. I'm pretty sure, as I say, that's where he's from. But, you know, I guarantee that there'll be, you know, Bush lawyers out there busy serving.
Right, so like, let's like just that. Take so, this down and it'll go away.
Yeah, basically, yeah. What the US does have is a thing called the Office of Research Integrity, and they are tasked with looking into more sort of fraud, I guess, more sort of the first thing that we were talking about, so sort of stealing results and that sort of thing. And that is a purely transparent process, and you do find out what happens to people in that case, and they generally are told that they can't apply for federal funding for 3 years or 5 years or something like that, which does seem to be a very, very small price to pay for fraud, you know. Mm. So I think, yeah, people need to be tougher on it, I think. And, basically, as I say, education is probably the key here. And if nobody submitted papers to these things, they would cease to exist. So obviously the fact that they're still out there means that people are still being sucked in, sadly.
Mm. And so finally, perhaps on a a lighter, more happy note, let's talk about a turtle reserve that you visited in Oman during your recent trip to the Middle East.
Indeed. So, yes, not so much holiday, but conference leave.
Apologies. Isn't that work slash holiday, though?
So I had to go to a conference in Cyprus, as you do. So Cyprus is a wonderful place, and I would thoroughly, thoroughly recommend it. We went to the northern part as well, which is occupied by Turkey, and so had to go across the UN demilitarized zone and all that, and that's a very interesting experience, etc., etc. And then my partner had a conference in Berlin that I had to go to as well, so went to Berlin for a few days, and then on the way home we thought, let's go to Oman because it's next to Dubai and flying through there anyway. And Oman is a wonderful, wonderful country. I'd say probably it's the safest Arab country on the planet at the moment, I would guess. Modern but not glitzy like Dubai.
Mm.
And we stayed out in the desert in a tent and all that stuff that you do when you're in that part of the world. But one place that we did go to was the turtle reserve, the Ras Al Jinn's turtle reserve, which we knew absolutely nothing about before we went. And so this is it's a turtle research lab, which is basically a building on the very, very easternmost tip of Oman. And on these beaches, turtles basically come and lay their eggs, all sorts of turtles, but mostly the green turtles. And these guys are big suckers. They can grow up to about 1.5 meters wow. in length. And so what they do is that they take you out at night after sundown onto the beach, and it's very sort of highly regulated and stuff. And you can go and see these big turtles laying eggs. And so they've got to dig these enormous holes in the sand, and they dig these decoy holes for the foxes because the foxes come and eat the eggs as well. So, and you can imagine digging a hole with your flippers when you're 1.5 meters in size takes a while.
Pretty long time.
And so that was utterly, utterly amazing. Once in a lifetime experience, you know, sitting there watching a turtle laying eggs on the beach. And then in the morning, that's when the eggs hatch, not the ones that have just been laid, obviously, but, you know.
That's a really fast incubation process.
Indeed. But the eggs hatch in the morning, and then you get to see these little guys, which are about sort of, you know, 5-10 centimeters long, and away they go, and they're just hightailing it for the water, and that was just utterly amazing, absolutely extraordinary. The sad thing being that 2 in 1,000 make it to maturity.
Oh.
So all of these little guys.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Why is it so bad?
Well, okay, on the beach you've got these crabs, which are enormous, and they're just sort of standing there waiting for these little guys. And you've got the foxes, which eat the eggs. You've got all sorts of birds, which are hanging around to grab them as well. Then you've got everything in the sea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so really, really sadly, so we made sure that the crabs didn't get any of these guys. We might have given them a bit of a helping hand possibly, but it's just a really, really amazing experience. So turtles are very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, when you sent me a link about it before, made me think about how there are obviously cases of good animal tourism that exists in the world as well as not so good ones.
Yeah, yeah,
and from
yeah.
what I could read about your one, it seems pretty ethical, but obviously there are cases of not so great ones. I mean, I know in Southeast Asia with elephant tourism is notorious trade.
Yeah, this is great. It's, you know, it's all basically natural, and they limit it. They limit the number of people that are allowed on the beach, etc., etc. So
right, so it's really regulated and carefully done.
Yeah,
awesome.
Very much so. So, yeah, if people listening, if you're ever close to Oman, I would really, really highly recommend it. Wonderful place.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining us today, Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
Not a problem.
We'll see you again next week.
Shall do. Thanks, Shamina.
That was Dear Science.
It was indeed.
The Wire.
It is The Wire. That's the show we are on. Our next piece, Adam, is going to tell you about.
So, one of the country's most pristine water sources is in line for the highest level of environmental protection to preserve its crystal clear waters. Announced earlier this week by the Minister for the Environment, Nick Smith, the Te Whaikoropupu Springs application for a water conservation order has been accepted. I spoke with the minister this morning, first asking what the reasons were for the proposal's acceptance.
Well, the Waikaropuupu Springs is New Zealand's largest in the country, quite huge. About 12,000 litres of water a second come out of the ground in a special part of the Golden Bay.
Mm-hmm.
But what's even more amazing is that the water is just incredibly clear. Most river water, good clean river water, you could see through for about 10 metres. This water has a clarity of 63 metres, some of the clearest measured anywhere in the world. Now, the Water Conservation Order mechanism is like a sort of national park or reserve of a water body. We have 15 of them around New Zealand. 13 cover rivers. A couple apply to lakes, but we've never applied one to a spring before. It's the highest level of protection that's possible for a water body, and I just think for such a iconic water body, it's entirely appropriate, and that's why I've accepted the application from the local iwi, Ngāti Tama.
I also understand that Ngāti Tama raised concerns with the Tasman District Council in March regarding bottling companies. Did this play into your decision at all when granting this proposal?
Not really. The principal issue for me is the legal test of whether the Waikaropuupu Springs is an outstanding water body of national significance. And my answer to that is yes. And then you come down to, well, if you are going to protect it, what are the potential risks to it being there, say, for our grandkids? And there are two issues. One of those is extraction of the water, and the other issue is pollutants, particularly that the springs are fed by an area of farming, principally dairy farming. There is measurement, a very low level of nitrates. But here's the really tricky scientific question. We know that there are these microorganisms that exist deep within the aquifer that are having this amazing effect of making this water so clear. How will they be impacted by the human activity and those nitrates?
Right.
Now, I've appointed a tribunal to consider the detail of the Water Conservation Order, and a really key piece of that will be getting the very best scientific advice about limiting those nutrients, limiting that extraction, to make sure that springs is going to be around forever.
So these will be part of the specific details of the conservation order as reining in the agriculture runoff around the spring then?
Yes, there's a small town of Takaka that also feeds into it, so I don't want to target the farmers alone. But what I want to see in the detail of the water conservation order protecting these Pupu springs is for the limits to be placed on nitrates and other pollutants, the limits to be placed on water takes, simply to ensure that these springs are around. Golden Bay is a pretty iconic environmental area with the Abel Tasman National Park, the Kahurangi National Park, the massive bird sanctuary out at Farewell Spit, and it's a place that's visited by over 90,000 people per year. It's a tourist destination in its own right.
Mm.
And so all those things, in my view, justify us taking a pretty precautionary view about human activity and ensuring that the springs are protected.
And so who will be involved in this special tribunal in deciding the final outcome of this conservation order?
Well, I'm going to publish the application. It's now available on the Ministry for the Environment's website. The tribunal will then hear submissions, and anybody from all over the country is welcome to submit on the proposal. Then after that, the tribunal will make a recommendation. Those recommendations can be appealed to the Environment Court. When that process is completed, it comes back onto the desk of the Minister for the Environment, and a final decision is made. I'm expecting that process to take about a year.
Right. And finally, this application was first proposed 4 years ago. Why has it taken so long for it to be, I guess, taken as seriously as it has been now?
What occurred 4 years ago was that the Minister for the Environment wrote back to Ngāti Tama and said there was insufficient information in the application, and that if they wanted to progress it, that they needed to provide that extra information. There has been increased controversy in the Golden Bay about the water body. I met with Ngāti Tama. I encouraged them to pull that information together and provided some assistance to ensure that could occur, and that's what's brought the application onto my desk into a form that I could accept.
Next, I spoke with Green Party water spokesperson, Catherine Delahunty, on the conservation order, asking what the Green Party's reaction was upon hearing of the acceptance.
Well, we're very pleased that Ngāti Tama Ki Waipounamu, who are the local tangata whenua, that they've managed to persuade the minister to proceed with the application. Nick Smith did answer a question of mine in the House about a month ago saying that he'd received the application and it would be processed. I hope that it proceeds rapidly, because some of these water conservation orders have sat around up to four years, and that is not what we need. We need this to be processed, and hopefully the special tribunal who will be looking into it will actually agree to it so that Waikorepupu Springs can be properly protected.
Because we spoke to Minister Smith just earlier and he said it will take about a year for the proposal to go fully through. Do you think this is still too long?
Well, what it really depends on is what the Tasman District Council do in the meantime, because they're in the middle of drafting a plan that would allow more water uptake from the aquifers and rivers adjacent to the springs that affect the springs. So long as in that year we don't see the District Council allowing more water consents to uptake a water that can impact on the springs and increase nitrates, that would be my concern. Is I know there's paperwork to be done when you're creating a water conservation order, because it's an important and high-level form of protection, but it needs to happen before there's any further degradation, because there are already issues with the springs around and the aquifers that feed it around nitrate.
The local iwi took the council to the High District Court regarding this. Do you feel like this was one of the major factors in why the proposal might have gone through?
I think that Ngāti Tama Ki Waipounamu must be congratulated, because not only did they take the water bottling application to court and won, they also challenged the Tasman District Council and they proposed this water conservation order. So they've been incredibly proactive with the support of the local community, and, you know, really the congratulations for the progress on the water conservation order is due to them. It's due to the leadership of the tangata whenua, who I've just been doing a tour around the country, and all over the country this kind of leadership is happening. From with their scarce resources, they're going to court to defend waterways, which benefits all of us, and particularly with a place like Waikorepupu, because it means so much not only to tangata whenua and mana whenua in the area, but also to the whole country. Anyone that's been there knows that if you can't protect Waikorepupu, you can't protect any water.
Do you feel like this is a reactionary proposal rather than something, a proactive action, and actually protecting our water sources?
Yeah, in terms of government, they didn't initiate this. They haven't done anything to protect waterways. They have, in the budget, given $63 million additional dollars to big irrigation to keep sucking up water from rivers. So they are definitely reacting to the fact that Waikorepupu is incredibly important to so many people and is a very populist and well-known issue. But they are not leading on water quality. They are not fixing the problem, and they are not prepared to when they keep funding big irrigation and coming up with water quality standards that are incomprehensible. We can congratulate the tangata whenua. We can't congratulate the government.
The first application for this Conservation Act was put forth nearly 4 years ago.
Yes.
Why does it seem like this has taken such a long time? Do you think that the government has kind of been dragged by its heels into actually accepting it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of other water conservation orders that have also been around for a long time. The amendment to the Rakaia Conservation Order, which is the Rakaia River, and there's another one, the Narudoro Clive application, and all of them seem to be taking a long time, and it's been very difficult for people to achieve this level of protection for water because they have to prove so much. There has to be so much evidence, and that can be used as an excuse to slow everything down. And in fact, it's not good. It's not good that people have to go through this enormous data collection and scientific process to prove that water is incredibly important and needs to be protected.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
You just heard Minister for the Environment, Nick Smith, and Green Party water spokesperson, Catherine Delahunty, talking about the acceptance of a water conservation order proposal for the Te Waikorepupu Springs. And now my producer, Will, has the final story.
A new survey has found that the majority of New Zealanders are not concerned about automatons replacing them in the workforce. The survey's findings will be part of a series of lectures presented by Massey University later this month, which analyses the implications of a more automated New Zealand job market. I spoke to Dr. David Brown, who conducted the study, asking him whether this was something more Kiwis should be thinking about and whether there was a need for concern.
Yeah, I think there's no point in worrying about it. You can just adapt to it, but I think people should be open to looking into the type of technology that's available and coming and see how that will change their work and workforce as a result.
What kind of jobs are most likely to be affected by automation in the workforce?
So we've sort of identified some key things around jobs that are really repetitive and not that complex. But, you know, all industries can be disrupted. There's obviously all the talk about driverless technology. You can see a lot of self-service kiosks going up in places. But really, if your job is really repetitive, it's susceptible to be automated by, you know, a robot or some kind of computer software.
So would you say that the jobs that are most likely to be affected are sort of industrial jobs or factory work? I mean, we've seen that in the past already. Would that continue on?
I think the main area that's going to be hit is going to be the service sector, because there's a big incentive to go after high-paying jobs and to automate tasks that are high-paying. So we're a service-based economy now, and we need to be aware that those jobs are on the line rather than the factory works and primary industries, because those already have been automated, as you've said.
So could you say there's not a specific targeting of a demographic who are earning less money? It's actually potentially targeting those who are providing repetitive services who are actually getting paid more?
Yep, that's correct. So, yeah, it's the incentive to go after high-paying jobs is there. And, yeah, it's going to affect a wide range of jobs. They effectively are just going to reverse engineer jobs and work out what the repetitive parts are and try and automate those. And again, that doesn't mean the entire job's going to disappear, but certain parts will be automated and there might be less jobs as a result of that.
So jobs for individual workers might change, but how will businesses change in the near future to remain relevant with potential growing influence of automation?
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting one. It's not really my area. We're more looking at employees, but you can already see that companies are finding it harder and harder to compete because of the, you know, other competitors that are automating. So if you can, I guess, automate your processes and drive costs down, you can stay competitive.
Lots of people have this idea that New Zealand arguably is behind the ball on sort of technology within the workforce or technology in general. How obvious will this change be in New Zealand? I know you can't forecast these things, but looking at the changes that have occurred now, what can we expect in the near future in comparison to other countries perhaps?
There's an interesting study by Fran Osborne, who look at the susceptibility of automation by country. Yeah, it's really hard to tell. I think it's really hard to predict these things in the long term. I think, you know, we just have to be aware of what's going on and make decisions based on that rather than sort of burying our heads in the sand about it. So it's a really difficult question to answer.
Yeah, it's interesting. You say people burying their heads in the sand, and that's sort of what was covered a lot in your study. Is that an issue? Is that going to affect people's jobs in the future if people aren't aware of this change?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, the people that we've found that are most at risk of being automated, or their jobs most at risk of being automated, are not worried about automation at all, whereas people that are in the lower risk professions are really worried about certain things being automated. So you have to, I guess, you know, there's that cognitive bias going on. But also I think when you ask people to think 10 years out into the future or 15 years, they kind of envision themselves in a different job or different line of work. So they're not thinking that their job or career as a checkout operator is going to be automated. They're thinking about their future line of work, the area they're perhaps studying in.
Yeah, as a student myself, what sort of skills would I be looking at if I was going to go into the job market and secure a job that I knew wouldn't be automated in the future, or I was pretty sure it wasn't going to be automated in the future?
Yep. I think there's a, you know, pretty good list of jobs and professions that, you know, they think are going to be automated. People should be looking at those. I think you also have to consider the, you know, we're always going to need people that can think critically and analyse things and think outside the box. So it's those types of skills. And again, all of these skills are listed out there on the web as to, you know, what things are susceptible to automation and what are not. And hopefully the degree or the program you're studying in ticks a lot of those boxes that keeps you safe.
Let's hope so, because I do not want to be replaced by a robot.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was Dr. David Brum talking about the ever-growing use of automatons in New Zealand's markets. And we've got a few texts in from some of the stuff that we've covered today. Well, we did get a phone call before from Mark Lewis, who is an older listener and drives night and day across Auckland, who believes a simple solution to congestion would be to have a campaign whereby unregistered and unwarranted vehicles are taken off the roads. I don't have the numbers for the numbers of unregistered and unwarranted vehicles, but I do know that Phil Goff told us this morning that we're getting 800 more cars on the road in Auckland every week. So I don't know, maybe they're comparable numbers, but we'll have to do a bit more research into that. Also got a message from somebody that why was there no foresight regarding the transport system in Auckland? It's a very good question, listener. And, of course, our dear friend Peter, who said, what? Another tax in regards to a congestion fee. The state gets fatter while we get poorer. Cheers, Peter. More freedom, less government.
That was The Wire.
Yes, and that is the end of our show today. Thank you, everyone who spoke with us. Matthew Lowry, Tracy Martin, Alan Blackman, Nick Smith, Catherine Delahunty, and David Brum. Thank you very much to Adam and Will for helping me with production this morning. And, of course, thank you for all of you who tuned in today, for texting and calling, etc. Great to hear your feedback, as always. But, yes, stay tuned for the 1 to 4 coming up next.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.